Welcome to today's webinar conducted by Winston Strawn. Our topic is titled Alternative Financing Sources, Potential Opportunities for Public Companies. My name is Mike Blankenship, and I'm a partner here in the Houston office. Today, I am joined by my colleagues Charlie Hay, Eric Johnson, Kat Morris, Christina Rupes, and David Sakowitz. Our agenda today will be go through convertible notes and concurrent hedging transactions, rights offerings, at-the-market offerings or ATMs, private investment and public equity, PIPE offerings, baby bonds, and then question and answers, which we'll do throughout the program. Before we turn to the subject of today's presentation, allow us to take a moment to explain a few things. If you're interested in obtaining CLE credit, we have created an electronic procedure to collect documentation on attendance. Yesterday, you were sent an email that contains a link to the CLE evaluation form. Today's webinar, we will mention the presentation code. Please make note of that code. You will need it to fill out your CLE activity evaluation form. Once you've completed the evaluation, we can send you a certificate of attendance within 1 week of the program. Note that after this program, we will also send the slide deck as well as a recording of it to you. To ask questions during the presentation, you can use the Q&A box located on the left-hand side of your screen. Type your question into the Q&A box and then click send. Your questions will not be posed to the entire audience. Only we can see them. We will try to answer your questions during the presentation, but if we do not get to it, we'll follow up via email. Please do not be shy. We welcome all questions. And now I'll turn it over to Christina.
Good morning, everyone, and afternoon, depending on you, where you are, and thank you for joining us. I'm going to begin this morning by talking a little bit about convertible notes. This is something that you may have read about or heard about in the news recently. There has been a significant uptick in the number of convertible note offerings that have been done in this COVID or post-COVID world, with upwards of 60 deals having priced in April and May of this year. Convertible notes are debt securities that can be converted into shares of the issuer's common stock, sometimes also convertible into cash at the issuer's election, which would be done for certain tax reasons, upon the meeting of certain specified conditions. Why are we seeing so many convertible note offerings being done in this particular market environment? There's a number of reasons, and we'll talk a bit later in this presentation about advantages and disadvantages of convertible note offerings. But the primary reasons why these are very attractive financing options for certain issuers are, first, that they contain lower interest rates than non-convertible debt. So, issuers who are concerned about cash flow, who have been impacted by COVID or other market conditions, are able to preserve cash flows with a lower interest rate than if they were doing a non-convertible debt issuance. Absent certain sort of unusual circumstances, convertible notes are unsecured. So, this is paper that is relatively easy to put in place. It does not include guarantees or other types of security. There is no financial or operating covenants restricting the issuer's operations, and this is particularly important for non-investment grade issuers. Issuers who would go into the market to issue debt, particularly into the high yield market, would expect to have significant operating covenants included in their debt documents, none of which would be applicable for convertible debt. And convertible debt is convertible only at a significant premium to current market prices. So even if the debt does convert, there is less dilution than if the issuer was to just do a straight equity offering at the lower market price that may be in place today. And to further mitigate the dilution, there are derivative products in place, which my colleague David Sakowitz will talk to you about, that allow the issuer to effectively increase that conversion premium to make it even higher than the initial pricing. And that comes with some upfront costs, which David will talk more about. I'm going to move now on to the next slide and walk through typical terms of a convertible note offering. So as I noted on the previous slide, interest rates are, significantly lower than non-convertible debt. Typical with most debt instruments, interest accrues semi-annually in arrears. for interest rates, we're seeing anything from, you know, sub 1% to upwards of 6%. So there's a fair range. Obviously, the creditworthiness of the issuer, the specific industry in which the issuer operates. In particular, you know, we're seeing retail, travel, industries that have been particularly hard hit by COVID are not surprisingly going to have higher interest rates. As I also mentioned, this is senior unsecured debt. Maturity, typically 5 to 7 years, though there is some variation. I think in the last couple of months, we've seen anything from 3-year maturity upward to upwards of 7 years. Conversion price, the debt typically converts at 10 to 35% above the last closing price. On the day of pricing. So that's going to be, you know, usually you price an offering post-market, that day's closing price is the price that you're using to tee the conversion premium. I would say we have been seeing 25 to 35% really being the most common range of conversion premiums and where issuers seem to be comfortable doing these transactions, though you do see conversion premiums as low as 10% and as high as upwards of 42%. There is a higher conversion premium typically is related to a higher coupon. So, you know, there are issuers who would rather take the lower coupon and lower the conversion rate and then, again, artificially inflate it by using a derivative instrument. In order to determine the shares that are issuable upon conversion, you take the face value of the notes divided by the conversion price. The conversion triggers include stock trading at a substantial premium for a period of time. Typically, that is in the 20 to 30% range for 20 out of a 30-day trading period. The notes trading below a specified value for a period of time, usually 10 trading days. Certain corporate events, so mergers, delisting of the issuer's common stock, or the issuer calling notes for the redemption, which I'll talk about in a moment. And there's also a free conversion period prior to maturity. The market has historically been, you know, 6 months prior to maturity, the notes are freely convertible. However, in recent deals, we've seen that window getting shortened to the benefit of the issuers down to 4.5 months. Shares are typically settled in common stock, cash, or both, again, at the issuer's election. And, you know, for optional redemption, we're seeing about a third of the deals that have been done in the last couple of months are being done non-call, so there is no optional redemption feature. For the two-thirds or so of deals that do include an optional redemption, you know, the notes are typically non-callable for some period, 3 to 4 years, depending on the maturity of the bonds. And then they can be provisionally redeemed if the underlying stock trades at a substantial premium, typically 130%. I think in almost every recent deal is the conversion or is the premium that's required. A redemption constitutes a make-whole fundamental change. So what that means is upon a make-whole fundamental change, the conversion rate is increased to compensate holders for the lost option value of their notes. So upon an optional redemption, a holder will have the ability to have their notes repurchased or to convert. And I think that about covers the typical terms. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, David Sakowicz, to talk through the advantages and disadvantages of convertible debt.
Thanks, Christina, and hello, everyone. So we just wanted to go into the advantages and disadvantages of these deals in a little bit more detail. Christina touched on a number of them already. The lower interest rate that is typically involved in a convertible debt deal is definitely an advantage for many issuers in the current environment, as is the absence of financial or operating covenants. And as Christina mentioned, particularly in a high-yield debt offering, there are significant restrictions on things like additional debt, payments, and investments. Those are designed to ensure the company's ability to pay over the life of the bonds, but companies find those covenants often to be quite restrictive, and especially over the course of a longer-term debt instrument, they can hinder their ability to react to changing circumstances. So none of those covenants appear in a typical convertible deal, and so issuers have a lot greater operating flexibility. Now, when you compare a convertible offering to a pure equity offering. Pure equity offerings can involve significant immediate dilution to existing stockholders, particularly at a time when stock prices may be on the low side. So structuring the offering as a convertible bond will have the effect of limiting and delaying the dilution to the common stock that would be involved in a pure equity offering. A key advantage to these deals is that they can get done pretty quickly. They can either be executed in public registered deals or in private offerings without a rating from a rating agency. And if they're done as a registered deal, it'll usually be done as a takedown off of an existing shelf registration statement. However, very often these are done as unregistered deals under the Rule 144A resale exemption. And generally, they're done without registration rights, so they're so-called 144A for life deals. And then finally, and we'll talk about this a little more, the issuer has the ability to enter into certain derivative transactions to effectively increase the conversion premium and to mitigate the effects of dilution. On the flip side, there are some disadvantages to going this route. Even though there's no immediate dilution as there would be in a pure equity offering, the potential dilution can have a negative impact on the market price of the stock. And also the stock price can be depressed by note investors selling their stock to establish an initial hedge position in connection with the offering. Of course, later on, there is potential for significant actual dilution if a large number of notes is actually converted to common stock. Another factor that issuers have to consider is that there are some very complicated tax and accounting issues involved in these deals. We could, in fact, spend a whole hour talking just about those at least. So internal finance and treasury personnel will need to devote a fair amount of time to the process and also to engage advisors early on in the process. We'll talk a little more later about the authorization and stock exchange listing process, and if the issuer does enter into the hedging transactions that we've been discussing, those transactions can be very expensive. So if we go to the next slide, a few other considerations that issuers need to be aware of. So even though no new shares are actually issued at the closing of a convertible debt offering, you still need to be able to issue the shares whenever it's required to do so under the terms of the bonds. So an issuer has to confirm at the outset that it has enough authorized shares available under its charter to issue the maximum number of shares required upon conversion, and that includes in the case of a make-whole fundamental change, as Christina described. And we also have to qualify those shares for listing on the relevant exchange. Now, if the company doesn't have enough authorized shares, there's probably going to be a delay in the offering because increasing the number of authorized shares generally requires a charter amendment, which in turn requires approval by the stockholders. And if you don't have an annual meeting coming up, there's probably going to need to be a special stockholders meeting called for that purpose. So aside from the delay involved in that, merely seeking approval from stockholders could signal to the market that the company has an offering or something else in mind, which itself could depress the stock price. And approval by the stockholders is not necessarily a slam dunk. The issuer also might need to look at existing debt agreements to see whether consents are required under those agreements to issue either the convertible notes itself or to enter into the concurrent hedging transactions. So, for example, other debt instruments might have limitations on indebtedness or restricted payments that need to be worked through. On the next slide, we talk about stock exchange requirements. Both NYSE and NASDAQ generally require stockholder approval for issuance that involve over 20% of outstanding shares. Now, there is an exception to this requirement for issuances that are at a price that's equal to or over the issuer's stock price, and generally convertible note issuances qualify for exception. However, there's an exception to the exception that issuers really need to be aware of, and it's that if the proceeds of the convertible debt offering are going to be used to finance an acquisition, then you have to aggregate the shares that are issuable upon conversion in the deal with any shares that might be issued in the acquisition to determine whether the 20% threshold is reached. And the idea there is to evaluate the potential dilution associated with the entire transaction holistically in order to determine whether dilution should require the prior sign-off of the stockholders. And as mentioned before, tax and accounting advisors should be engaged early and often to discuss appropriate appropriate structuring. All right, on the next slide. Now, as we talked about, dilution is a common concern of convertible note issuers, and convertible notes with a lower conversion premium have a greater potential for equity dilution. However, there are a number of strategies that issuers can use to reduce the potential for dilution. For instance, hedging transactions can be entered into with one or more financial institutions. Those institutions can include the underwriters in the note offering or their affiliates, or they can be other financial institutions. So these hedges have the effect of synthetically increasing the conversion premium of the notes, which effectively reduces the dilution risk. And they can also mitigate the downward pressure on an issuer's stock price that could result from short sales immediately following the offering. Now, the hedging transactions, when they're entered into, cover the number of shares of common stock that initially underlie the notes at the closing. And if the underwriters exercise their option to buy additional notes, which is usually a feature of these offerings, then an additional hedge will be entered into upon the exercise of that option. Now, this hedging strategy has become extremely popular. About 55% of all convertible note offerings since 2019 have included some sort of a concurrent hedging arrangement. The hedge is typically structured in one of two ways, and they're functionally and economically the same transaction. Now, the first structure is called a call spread overlay. And in this structure, the issuer will purchase a bond hedge from the financial institutions that entitles the issuer to receive some or all of the shares or the cash due upon conversion if and when the notes are converted. And then in a separate transaction and a separate document, the issuer will issue warrants to the counterparties. And those warrants will have an initial strike price that's higher than the conversion price of the notes. And this is done in order to offset the counterparty's initial short position in the bond hedge. And the warrants typically expire after the maturity date of the convertible notes. So with these two transactions together, the conversion price of the convertible bonds is effectively increased to the strike price of the warrants. Now, the other structuring option is called the capped call option. And just like in the call spread overlay, here the issuer purchases a hedge that entitles it to receive shares or cash due upon conversion if and when the notes are converted. Now, the wrinkle here is that the hedge documentation itself contains a cap on the value of the shares or the cash due upon the settlement. So this option is like the call spread, except instead of there being two separate transactions, the so-called warrant is embedded in the same instrument. Now, in each of these cases, the cost that the issuer will pay for the hedge at closing is determined through a competitive bid process with potential financial institution counterparties. And generally, the higher the effective conversion premium that results from the hedge, the higher the price paid is for the by the issuer for the hedge. Now, these transactions, in addition to being useful to the issuer, can be quite costly and quite profitable for the financial institutions that are involved. And it's sometimes a good idea for the issuer to get independent financial advice on these hedges from outside the underwriting group of the bond offering, particularly if the underwriters are also going to be option counterparties. Now, another way that issuers can reduce dilution is to use a portion of the proceeds from the offering to make a share repurchase at the same time. And usually one of the investment banks in the offering also will serve as the broker for the repurchase. Often the shares will be acquired from bond investors who would otherwise be selling short in the open market in order to establish their initial hedge position for the offering. And the repurchase price for the program will be the same as the reference stock price for the bond offering. And this is appealing to investors because the reduction in the outstanding share number reduces the net dilution potential upon conversion of the notes. So on the next slide, wanted to go through these a little bit quicker, but these are just some of the standard documentation that issuers will need in order to get one of these deals done. There will either be a purchase or an underwriting agreement, depending on whether it's a private deal or a public deal. It's an underwriting agreement and an SEC-registered deal and a purchase agreement and a 144A deal. They're essentially the same. They say that the issuer will sell the notes and the underwriters or initial purchasers will purchase the notes, and then there are related reps, warranties, indemnification provisions, and conditions to closing. The agreement usually contains a provision that prohibits the issuer from issuing shares for a specified period of time following the offering, which is up to 90 days. And this agreement is typically drafted initially by the underwriter's counsel. Separately, the underwriters will require lockup agreements from officers, directors, and big stockholders, where they agree not to sell shares or engage in certain other transactions in the shares for a period between 45 and 90 days after the offering. On the next slide, the prospectus or the offering memorandum is the basic disclosure document for these deals. For a registered offering, an issuer will need to have an effective registration statement and a prospectus for an offering off of a Form S-3 or F-3 shelf. Similarly, for an unregistered 144A offering, there will be an offering memorandum that contains largely the same information that would be in the prospectus. The 144A market, even though it's to qualified institutional buyers only, has evolved such that QIB investors expect prospectus-level disclosure, and regardless, issuers in any offering need to be comfortable that they're satisfying their 10b-5 obligations not to set forth any material misstatements or omissions. And the offering document is typically drafted by issuer counsel, except for the provision the provisions that describe the notes and the related deal terms, and that's usually drafted by underwriter's counsel initially. The indenture is the agreement between the issuer and the trustee setting forth the terms, and that's usually drafted by underwriter's counsel based on the description of the notes after it is finalized. As part of the diligence process, the underwriters need to establish their due diligence defense, just as in any other offering of securities. So the issuer will provide them with legal and business diligence information, including backup support for everything that's everything material that's in the disclosure document. And there's generally a comfort letter from the independent accounting firm with respect to the financial data in the document. On the next slide, the listing of the additional shares issuable upon conversion with the relevant exchange, it's normally a very straightforward process. And historically, stock exchange approval of the listing has been a condition to closing. However, under recent circumstances, including the administrative delays related to COVID-19, underwriters have been showing some flexibility on waiving this condition if the parties don't expect the listing to be an issue. And then finally, if the issuer does enter the hedging transactions that we talked about, then for each type of transaction, there needs to be a bond hedge confirmation with the financial institution. And if there are warrants as part of the call spread overlay option, then that requires separate documentation as well. On the next slide is just a list of recent convertible debt offerings. I won't spend too much time on this slide other than to note that the very small size of the font in the table indicates just how many of these offerings there have been recently. So if you squint really hard, you'll see that these deals are just from April and May of this year, and they cover offerings of a wide range of sizes for companies in a broad array of industries. So these are companies that evidently have determined that the advantages of convertible debt that we've been talking about outweigh the disadvantages, and that these offerings are a good way to raise capital in the current uncertain environment. And now I'll turn things back over to Christina, who will talk to us about rights offerings. Christina.
Thank you, David. So rights offerings are another type of securities offering that we are seeing a significant uptick in this uncertain market environment. In a rights offering, the issuer gives its existing stockholders the opportunity to buy a pro rata portion of additional shares of the issuer's common stock at a set subscription price. And that subscription price is typically a discount to recent trading prices of the issuer's common stock. So these rights would be distributed by the company to all holders of the common stock on a specified record date. And there is no dilutive effect on stockholders that exercise their rights. This is particularly important as it relates to stock exchange listing requirements. There's no stockholder approval required, even if the rights result in the issuance of an excess of 20% of the outstanding shares, because the rights are being offered to all of the company's existing stockholders, and therefore they potentially will not have a dilutive effect on the existing stockholders who choose to exercise. However, similar to the discussion David just had around conversion rights, the company does need to confirm that it has sufficient authorized shares so that if all of the rights being offered are in fact exercised, the company can issue the shares in exchange for those rights. Rights are generally non-transferable, which means that the right stays with the stockholder, and if the stockholder doesn't exercise its right, it will then experience, that particular stockholder will experience dilution. Issuers may elect to make their rights transferable. However, doing so does add a fair amount of complexity, as the rights themselves may need to be registered securities, and they may also need to be listed on a stock exchange. The benefit to holders of transferable rights is it essentially allows the holder to trade their right at a profit to offset their potential dilution in the event that they don't exercise their right. Another issue with transferable rights is it creates more of a market, whereas the companies that have transferable rights very often will hire a dealer manager to come in and, you know, sort of solicit exercises of stock, which comes with additional expense. So it does create a market for the rights, but it does come with some additional cost as well. Rights offerings are typically open for about 16 to 30 day period during which rights can be exercised, and the company needs to be cognizant of the pricing of the rights. If you have a particularly volatile stock, for instance, there could be a lot of movement in that 16 to 30 day period. So companies need to be cognizant of pricing their rights at a price that will be appealing to investors given the time that the offer remains open. Something else that's a little bit unusual and different about rights offerings than some of the other types of offerings we'll talk about today is that there's a requirement to put out a press release, which is a requirement of the stock exchanges 10 days in advance of the record date. So essentially, a company will notify the market that a rights offering is coming before having a registration statement or any other documentation relating to the rights offering. So there is, there may be some initial impact on the stock that can get priced in as a result of that lead time for a rights offering. Rights offerings typically include what we call an oversubscription privilege, which means that stockholders who do in fact exercise their rights may choose to exercise in excess of the existing rights that they have to cover some of the shares that are attributable to stockholders who do not choose to exercise their rights. If there's more investors that take advantage of the oversubscription privilege than there are shares of common stock available to be distributed, the oversubscription privilege will be managed on a pro rata basis amongst those stockholders taking advantage of the privilege. Turning now to the next page, there are typically two types of rights offering, a backstop rights offering and a direct rights offering. In a backstop rights offering, there's a third party that agrees to buy the shares associated with rights that aren't exercised in the offering. That third party very often will be some sort of an investment bank that will take a fee for, you know, standing in the background as that standby purchaser, which overall will increase the price or cost to the company of doing a rights offering. In some situations, the backstop purchaser could be an affiliate of the company, a significant stockholder. So there's some variation here, but companies should be aware that where they do put a backstop commitment in place, that typically does come with some increased cost, the highest of which will be in a situation where it's an independent third-party investment bank serving in that capacity. The benefit of a backstop rights offering from an issuer's perspective is that there's a guaranteed amount of capital that will be raised. So theoretically, there could be a rights offering where no stockholders or a very limited number of stockholders take advantage of the right to exercise, in which case the company will bring in a you know, a de minimis amount of capital. By backstopping the rights offering, an issuer will have a guaranteed amount of capital that comes in. So, you know, if only $10 million of a $50 million rights offering is exercised, the backstop party will step in and take the additional $40 million. This is a format that's most often used where there's very specific capital needs. So if a company, for instance, needs to finance an acquisition, or it has a very volatile stock price, as I mentioned earlier, and there's concern that the exercise price may not be attractive if the stock price moves significantly during the offering period. In situations where it's an existing investor or a related party or affiliate that serves as the backstop purchaser, just kind of, you know, something to be aware of is there's potential additional broker-dealer issues that could come into play. So there's some additional inquiry and diligence that needs to be done in that situation. To contrast that with a direct rights offering, there's no backstop commitment party or a standby purchaser. So as I indicated, if rights aren't exercised for one reason or another, which could include market events that occur during the offering period, the company will just bring in a small amount of capital, and it could potentially leave the issuer without adequate capital. The benefit is that it's less expensive, and most often is used by issuers that don't have a specific capital need. So, you know, it would be helpful to have additional cash on the balance sheet, but there's not an immediate need for it, or there's not an immediate significant need for that cash. So if there is a low subscription rate, the issuer won't be in a really negative financial position. Turning to the next page, I will walk quickly through documents for a rights offering. So these are registered offerings. They're typically takedowns off of an effective shelf registration statement. That will include a prospectus or prospectus supplement for an offering. The registration statement will register the shares issuable upon exercise of the rights. However, if the rights are transferable, then the rights themselves may also need to be registered on the registration statement. If it's a backstopped offering, there will be a standby purchase agreement, and that standby purchase agreement, will be executed with the backstop purchaser and will include representations and warranties at the company, and there may be an additional level of diligence that's required as well for the standby purchaser. As I mentioned, there's a listing of additional shares, but there should not with the various stock exchanges, but stockholder approval will not be required for these types of offerings. And additionally, going to the next slide, as I mentioned earlier, there's a press release requirement by the stock exchange. So there will be a press release that goes out at least 10 days in advance of launching the offering, which tells the market that there's a rights offering that will be coming. There's a slew of subscription documents, letters to holders, election forms, or subscription rights certificates that need to be actually sent out to holders. And then, as I mentioned, due diligence. There's, again, very limited due diligence in a rights offering, and particularly with a direct rights offering, there's really no counterparty to be doing diligence outside of reviewing the offering documents. But in a situation where there's a standby purchaser, there may be enhanced diligence requirements for that standby purchaser. I guess the last thing I will note here before turning it over to Charlie on ATM offerings is that, you know, the additional benefit of rights offerings is there's very limited marketing required, in particular where rights are non-transferable. So, you know, the potential investor base is your existing investors. They should already know the company. It requires very little effort of management to go out and market. The distinction is where there are not transferable rights. Again, you may get a dealer manager involved. It may require more time of management to actually go out and solicit now holders of rights who are not existing stockholders of the company and convince them that they want to exercise those rights. And that is it for rights offerings. I'll turn it over to my partner, Charlie Haig, to talk about ATM offerings.
Thanks, Christina. Good morning or good afternoon to everyone. This is Charlie Haig in the Dallas office, and I'll be covering at-the-market offerings or ATM programs. So we're covering a lot today, and so my presentation and the others don't go into all of the technical details that some of you may want, and we'd be happy to discuss any of those technical issues with you after the program if you're interested. So what are ATM programs? On slide 22, And the first bullet says that their follow-on offerings where a public company sells new shares into the market through broker-dealers. And you're probably thinking, well, that sounds just like a normal traditional underwritten offering, and you'd be right. And you're also right if you read the second bullet that says that as the broker-dealers sell those shares, the issuing company receives cash, which can be used for a variety of purposes. That's also just like a traditional underwritten offering. The third bullet is really the key to what makes ATM special and why they've become so popular in recent years. And that is that ATM programs give the company control and flexibility to start and stop the offering, increase or decrease amounts sold, depending on price, need for capital, and whatever other factors are important to an issuing company. So an example of when an ATM program works really well, and I'll use the REIT industry because REITs have been using these for a lot longer than other companies in other industries because of the frequent capital needs of REITs. So a REIT at the beginning of a year may decide that it's going to be chasing a bunch of deals, buying buildings that could be office buildings, multifamily, whatever it specializes in. And they don't know if they're going to get these deals or not, but if they do, they may need $10 or $20 million of equity per deal, and they may need that a lot in one quarter, or they may not get any deals for many quarters. And so one of the things that they can do for flexibility is if they have a shelf or if they don't have a shelf, you know, file one, get an ATM program in place, do the work, and then they're ready to sell at any time when they get a deal. And if you're talking about relatively small amounts of capital, they can be pretty confident that the market can support those small, say, $5, $10, $20 million equity raises needed for each deal as they come up. And compared to a traditional underwritten offering where, first, the market wouldn't support a small deal like that, and the costs of doing an underwritten offering for such a small deal would likely be prohibited. So turning to the next page, what's required to get an ATM offering set up? And, you know, like I talked about before, the documents are a lot like a traditional underwritten offering. You need a registration statement, and you also need to be eligible to use Form S-3 or F-3 for a foreign private issuer. And because we're giving CLE credit, I'll talk quickly about the technical reason there is Rule 415 under the Securities Act, which allows for continuous offerings, basically doesn't work for an ATM program on Form S-1 the way that we want to do it. And so you need to use an S-3, and this can be important for newly public companies where you have executives that have been at other companies, had ATM programs, loved them, and want to use them. And for that new public company, whether it's from a spinoff or from an IPO, you just need to know that you need to wait a year, be S-3 eligible before the ATM works. So for a registration statement, you can do a new S-3. If the company's a WKSE, it can be effective immediately, and you can be ready to go right away. If you're not a WKSE, you got to go through the review process. For a company that has an existing shelf, it's super likely that the plan of distribution is broad enough to cover an ATM program, so you wouldn't have to do a new one. You just have to do the takedown documentation. And that includes that next bullet, the distribution sales agreement. That's the agreement that looks a lot like an underwriting agreement and replaces the underwriting agreement for an ATM offering. It has the same types of reps and warranties and has the same, generally the same delivery requirements as far as comfort letters, legal opinions, 10b-5 negative assurance. Along with that, the underwriter and their counsel will do traditional underwriting due diligence at the time the ATM program is set up. And then again, each quarter, basically right after the Q is filed, the company and the underwriters will work to do a bring down if the company chooses to be able to keep that ATM program effective. And so the amount of work here for an ATM program is very similar to what you do for an underwritten offering. The difference is that you do it once, and then you're ready to go for what can be 3 years or possibly longer, although you'll have to renew your shelf. And so once that work is done, the offering, and I'm going to the next page here, but the offering can literally be done with an email from an executive to the bankers saying to sell, and just for an example, $10 million of stock at a price of 20 or higher, and the bankers can hit the market and do those deals if the market supports really quickly. And so that takedown documentation when you actually do sales is very easy and very light. So continuing with other advantages and disadvantages, these are smaller deals and can have limited market impact. So the idea is you can trickle or dribble out shares into the market, do small amounts that don't put a lot of downward pressure on the price. But the counterpoint to that on disadvantages is that you really can't do really big deals because it would be unusual for the market to support in an ATM program large volume. And so a recent example of that is a Shake Shack deal. So Shake Shack, obviously a restaurant. We didn't work on this deal, but it's interesting and got some publicity in the market. But Shake Shack, being a restaurant and hard hit by the COVID pandemic, needed capital. They did a $75 million ATM program announced in April. And so they have that for flexibility, but very soon after they announced that $75 million program, they did a traditional $140 million underwritten offering. And so speculating on the reason, which this is not hard speculation, is they couldn't do an at-the-market offering to raise $150 million, but they could do an at-the-market offering to give them flexibility. And then on top of that, do the underwritten offering for the large capital infusion they needed right away. And in fact, in April, when they announced soon after they announced the ATM program, they announced that they had done $150 million total. And so remember, they had a $75 million ATM program. They did 10 off that, plus they did another $140 million. So they got $150 million with the mix of the ATM program, the underwritten offering. And then they still have $65 million left for the rest of the year and longer on the ATM program should the need come up. So continuing on flexibility, that the magic that I talked about in the first slide, companies can start and stop these whenever they want, and that's the real advantage. But, of course, the market price has to support doing the offerings when the company goes to raise capital, and so that can be a disadvantage because the market price may not support the deal you want to do at the time you want to do it, in which case you may need to do a PIPE or some of the other alternatives discussed in this presentation. Moving down to lower cost, the legal fees for doing these deals are about the same as an underwritten offering. We already talked about the documents being about the same and the deliveries being about the same. But the big difference, the biggest cost in doing a public offering is the underwriting discounts and commissions. And for an ATM, they're about half of a traditional public offering. So if a company is used to paying 4% for the deals it does with underwriters, traditional offerings, an ATM program will probably be 2%. So you can see that there's a huge cost savings there for a program of $100 or $200 million over a couple of years compared to paying double the commissions for doing those deals. And there's limited board involvement going forward. That example I gave earlier where somebody in management sends an email to the bankers and tells them to sell, and that gets the offering basically going, and it's like ordinary trading from that point because you've already delivered the documents for the quarter up front. You also don't need to go back to the board. In a traditional underwritten offering, you normally have the board, or the board appoints a pricing committee, and then with whatever marketing efforts there are, you go back for approval. Again, that's usually handled up front, and then the actual takedown is just done by management. And I think we've talked about the documentation. There's really no disadvantage there. There's just not an advantage on ATMs because the documents are about the same. So comparing an ATM to a traditional offering on the next page, you'll see that on these factors we listed, ATMs are generally better on everything. And the big question is marketing and whether the market will support the size of the deal you want to do. But as far as impact on stock price, you know, generally ATM program is done at market prices and it doesn't push the stock down. If it does, you wouldn't do the deal. Traditional offerings obviously can have a much bigger impact on stock price. And that kind of it leads to another important factor that's not directly addressed here, and that's that there can be a lot more reputational risk on a traditional offering. If a company announces a $100 million offering, it doesn't want to fail to complete that offering. And I'm talking about traditional underwritten offerings here. It doesn't want to fail to price it, and it also doesn't want to price it at a huge discount to the market price. So once you announce a deal, a traditional underwritten deal, there's a lot of pressure to close and to price really at any price for reputational reasons. An ATM program, if it's announced and it turns out the market doesn't support it, there is no reputational risk. Basically, you know, you did it for flexibility, and if it's not used, it's not used. The timing for an ATM offering, you know, there's kind of two parts here. Setting up the program takes about the same time as a traditional offering. But then once you go to do the deal, it is, like I said, that email to the bankers super fast, same day. And on frequency, you can do those with takedowns as frequently as the company wants, as long as the market supports. And there's no new process that starts over like in an underwritten offering where each time you're starting over and you're redoing the documentation. And, of course, for a frequent issuer, that can be relatively easy to update things, but it's still not as easy as an email to your bank group to do sales. And we've talked about the control being a huge advantage. You can start or stop when you want. The fees, as we discussed, are lower. And as far as management involvement, there is no roadshow or special marketing efforts. The bankers are selling at a price the market supports, which can be a great price or may not be, depending on the company's situation. And then lastly, on lockups, there are no lockup agreements for directors and officers for an ATM program like there are for underwritten offerings, and that can be a huge deal, as we all know, for some companies to avoid those lockups. So from this comparison slide, you can see why companies would be interested in ATMs, and on the next page, we discuss the current market. So far this year, there have been over 100 deals, and you know what we've seen is a lot of companies knew they were going to need capital because of the pandemic and market conditions. A lot of companies thinking ahead set up ATM programs, and now as the prices have recovered, they're able to tap those ATM programs. They've been able to raise a lot of money. A lot of this won't be announced until the 10-Qs are filed, but they've worked great for those companies that did the work in advance so that they're ready to go as trading prices recover. So they're a great option for companies that plan ahead and can take advantage, if they get the program set up, can take advantage of market prices when they support deals. And they can provide capital for smaller capital needs where a company doesn't want to put a ton of cash and have the dilution immediately on the balance sheet and not know whether it's going to need those later on. And then we talk about the flexibility here, which is the real advantage to all these. And I mean, in this market, companies are still unsure of their capital needs over the course of the year, and this is something great to give companies that flexibility going forward. And we include on our last slide several examples of recent deals, including ones that we worked on. And you can see that, you know, these used to be just for REITs, and we still have REITs on here, very popular in that industry. But really since the financial crisis, 2008 and 2009, they've become more popular across industries, and we're continuing to see that now. In energy and in retail, including we had the Chewy's deal, which we worked on, that was announced last week in the restaurant space, and I'd already talked about Shake Shack doing one earlier. Those haven't been, the restaurant industry traditionally hasn't used these, but they're using them in this market. If anyone's interested in looking more of this, we'd be happy to talk about it. Or if you look at the slide of recent deals, you can pull up the 8-Ks around the dates listed, and that'll give you examples of documents covering what I've discussed here today. And with that, we can move on. Mike?
Thank you, Charlie. So for those looking to get CLE credit, the code is 70932. Again, that's 70932. And I'll now turn over the presentation to Eric Johnson to kick it off on pipes.
Thanks, Mike. What is a pipe? Let's quickly go through these as we're running out of time. But what is a pipe? A pipe is a private placement of a public company's equity or equity-linked securities. Think convertible preferred stock, convertible debt, warrants, or a combination of any of those, to investors, where that the sale of those securities is conditioned upon the company agreeing that it will have a resale registration statement covering the equity or the underlying shares that would be declared effective by the SEC following closing. Investors have typically been institutional investors, but we've noted in recent years and certainly in the last few months as we've dealt with COVID-19, you're starting to see a large number of private equity firms with dry powder that are looking at some of these transactions with some of the value destruction that's been seen, although a lot of that's been covered back over. The PE shops are definitely looking at these deals as well. Current trend really in this distressed environment has been to use preferred stock inside the pipe. Historically, we've seen more just straight common stock. We've seen a lot of preferred stock here of late. I think the investors like it because you see opportunities around flexibility and the priority over common stock. Issuers like it as well. I think one of the things we've heard throughout this presentation, both in the convertible notes, inside the ATM, is flexibility around cost and pricing. If you think about the preferred stock, and you have cash flow issues in the near term, you can see issuers that will have dividends that are lower in the first couple of years and that ramp up in later years. So, again, flexibility and priority in the current environment, in this current distressed environment, we're starting to see a lot more preferred stock. Quickly on advantages and disadvantages of a PIPE versus a public offering. Really, in short, on the advantage side, it's cheaper, it's quicker, and typically can be done with less disclosure, all significant advantages to the issuer. In a normal pricing environment, you typically would see some significant discounts, which the issuer obviously doesn't like. The investor base is obviously a smaller pool, again, largely institutions, accredited investors, although the PE guys are starting to look around in it as well. And then there are some size limitations historically through the rules and shareholder approval requirements from the exchanges, although Mike will talk a little bit about that in a minute, how right now through the end of June, we've got some relief in that regard that simplifies some of that. Next slide. Historically, a PIPE would have been structured as a commitment from an investor to purchase the securities with some price protection, an ability to adjust the pricing and what he was getting if there was, poor market conditions, poor market response, et cetera. And then the requirement to fund that PIPE would have been conditioned on that resale registration statement becoming effective. Almost all PIPEs now, which you'll see, is kind of a fixed price deal without that kind of price protection. And then the registration obligation handled on a post-close basis, usually within 45 to 90 days after close. PIPE trends. PIPEs, had kind of started to back off just a little bit. The popularity of confidentially marketed public offerings, CMPOs, and other unannounced and accelerated offering alternatives had really kind of started to replace a lot of the PIPE volume. But as the capital markets of late have been inaccessible, and companies are looking around at opportunities to raise capital, the PIPE offering has started to grow again in its popularity. And I think we'll continue to see that over the next few months, certainly I think through the end of this year, as companies attempt to access capital.
So going through the key documents or standard documents for a PIPE, you have an engagement letter typically that will be between the issuer and the placement agent, which is the investment bank looking to place the securities, which that document itself is the only binding agreement between the issuer and the placement agent. It fills and describes its fees, expense reimbursement, exclusivity period, or tail, is there a right of first refusal, indemnification, and there will be certain conditions precedent, such as will the placement agent receive a comfort letter, will they receive legal opinions, and how those, what those opinions will look like, as well as we'll ask an issuer counsel to deliver the 10b-5 or negative assurance letter. So the next is confidentiality agreements. These are trading restrictions. Right now, you know, a lot of investors don't want to have material non-public information, so they're so that they wouldn't have to be cleansed. They still want to trade in the stock, so there's, you know, depends on whether that may or may not happen. The next is kind of marketing, what that looks like as far as investor presentations, private placement memorandum. Typically, investors are not given projections or anything, again, that has material non-public information. The next is the purchase agreement. These are securing how structuring the securities are purchased by the investors. A placement agent will not be party to that typically, and it'll usually be prepared by placement agent's counsel or the lead investor's counsel preparing that purchase agreement, as well as the registration rights agreement that will need to likely be in place, because as these are the private placement, anyone with current shelf in place cannot issue this, cannot provide a resale on that shelf for these securities. So they have to put up a new S3 or S1, as the case may be. The next is sort of certificate of designations. This comes into play, as Eric pointed out, a lot of convertible preferred are the way that PIPEs are going right now. We have a couple examples in here, but we point out that we're not going to go through them given the time, but you also have sort of description designations there. The next is the indenture. Again, if there's convertible notes issued as part of a private placement, you'll have an indenture set out. Shareholders agreement setting forth whether or not there's what the governance will look like. You also have other closing documents such as press release, which press release typically are under 135C will be issued before announcement of the transaction. So the next is what kind of approval is needed from NASDAQ and NYSE. They both require approval from those exchanges if the issuer is issuing more than 20% of its stock. It's not required under NYSE rules if that amount is greater than 20%, if it meets an offering for cash or one that's at or above the minimum price. You know, a lot of issuers, you know, they're also, I want to point out the affiliate rule that they also, NYSE requires shareholder approval if the number of shares or common stock to be issued is exceeds 1% or either the number of shares of common stock voting power before the issuance or 5% of either the number of shares or common stock is to a related party. In May, both NYSE and NASDAQ provided some relief to that, and I'll quickly provide what the NYSE did. This relief was only up until June 30th and 30 days following the date of a binding agreement covering the issuance of that company certification. So in order to do that, they would have to ask for approval. They'd have to have a material adverse impact on the company's ability to maintain operations under its pre-COVID-19 business plan, results in a workforce reduction, adversely impact the company's ability to undertake new initiatives in response to COVID-19, or the proceeds will not be used to fund an acquisition. And they also need to get the audit committee to approve the offering. And so that, if they do all that, they will be able to avoid the 20% rule. So the kind of last kind of thing we'll point out here, there's a lot more on this, as Charlie pointed out, you know, we're able to have to answer any questions, but one thing to keep in mind is that if it's a large, certain large transaction, you may need HSR filing or the Hart-Scott-Rodino filing disclosure as well. So I'll turn to Eric to talk about quick points.
Yeah, I think in the current environment, as we think about key negotiation points, you think about the pricing, you think about if we're talking about preferred stock, which we are generally in this environment, and you think about addressing cash flow concerns, can you pay your dividends in kind, or can you increase them over time such that in the short term and medium term you have less of a dividend obligation? So you're seeing a lot of kind of negotiation around discounts and premiums and dividend payments, certainly for sure. With respect to governance, and this has always been out there, but I think as PE has entered the space a little bit more, we're seeing more and more focus. Certainly, if it's a larger size investment, where the investor is much more serious about board seats and consent rights and information rights and other things like that. So that's something for both issuers and investors to stay hyper-focused on. But I think those are really the key kind of negotiation points that we've been dealing with here in the near term.
So here are just a few recent deals, and the market is pretty hot right now. Pipe, it's, this data was as of the Q1. It's been much higher since then during the COVID pandemic. So we expect it to continue to do that as certain industries, energy, tourism, aviation, have trouble attracting certain capital. And with that, I'll turn to our one and only alternative financing debt product, but I'll let Chad talk about baby bonds.
Great. Good afternoon, I guess now, everybody. It's Cap Morris. I'm a partner in Chicago in the Capital Markets and Security Group. I'm going to talk about baby bonds. They're kind of a smaller section of the alternative fundraising, but they can be an excellent way to raise money that is very convenient and has a lot of flexibility and very issuer favorable terms. So what is a baby bond? Basically, it's a fixed income security that is issued in smaller denominations. So they're a lot like an investment grade corporate bond where they don't have a lot of covenants, but they're denominated not in $1,000 per bond, but in $25 increments typically. The other aspect of them is that they are exchange traded. So they are the liquidity is provided by the listing on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, as opposed to the large institutional markets. So that provides the benefit of liquidity through a retail component, who's typically who they're marketed to. To be honest, institutional investors are not interested in these at all. And that's where they trade. So that is basically, and they trade like stocks, because the investors, they trade it basically off of the $25 par. So they'll trade 23 to 27, depending on movements of interest rates and company prospects. Who issues these? They're very popular in the utility world as a common way to raise capital, and they'll do them having maturities 30, 50, even 100 years. Business development companies love them. They do them in the smaller amounts, 25 to 150 million. And then surprisingly, a lot of corporate issuers like AT&T, Brunswick, Ford, eBay, GATX, one we worked on recently, and they'll do those. The corporate issuers will typically do them in the 5 to 10-year range. So why would you use baby bonds? Like I said before, they're very flexible for smaller size issuances. When someone either cannot issue a large amount or does not want to issue, a large amount. And normally in the bond world, there's an index trading minimum requirement of $350 million that you can get below and substitute that index eligibility with the exchange listing. So people can do them in the $25, $100, $150 million range. They're kind of permanent capital, particularly at the longer end of the maturity range, because they're so covenant light, which we'll get to in a minute, that you basically, as long as you're paying interest, you can forget about these because there really is nothing else to do with these. They're almost always unsecured, which, again, makes them very flexible. They are callable eventually, though, like investment-grade bonds. They do have a no-call period. But once you pass the no-call period, unlike, you know, high-yield or investment-grade bonds, they tip over to a par call option. So they kind of go from non-call to 100% or par. And then, as I said, covenant light, these are extremely issuer favorable terms. They basically have a covenant package that's equivalent to a AAA corporate issuer, which basically means you have to pay principal and interest timely. And that's it, other than maybe maintain corporate existence and a paying office, you know, some technical points. But there are no maintenance covenants. There's no financial covenants. It really is principal and interest. So that's why you would use them. In terms of some unique features of baby bonds, firstly, they're always SEC registered. This is because of the retail component and the exchange listing. The bigger corporate issuers can use S3 if they're eligible. Smaller capital constrained companies who don't meet S3 eligibilities, or BDC companies, business development companies who don't have any public float, they have to use S1. It does add some complexity because it is reviewed potentially. Another unique feature of baby bonds compared to corporate, typical corporate debt, is they have a green shoe or an over allotment option. So you do have to have a 15% extra offering piece. As I said, they're exchange listed. Typically, you know, the issuer is already registered with the exchange, so that's pretty streamlined. However, you do need a minimum float of $25 million. And that minimum float, where it gets interesting, it's a bond, unlike stock, is applied per issuance, because the coupon typically is unique because you're selling it into a unique market. So each series of baby bonds you issue has to equal $25 million to meet NYSE and NASDAQ listing criteria. As I said, the terms can range anywhere from, you know, 3 years to 100. Kind of the sweet spot for corporate issuers is 5 to 10, and utilities will go out on the longer portion of the curve, 30, 50. Redemption rights, I spoke previously, but typically if it's a 10-year bond, it's 3 years where they're no call, and 5 year on a longer maturing bond, and they're callable always at par. The coupon is a little higher. That's the payoff for the lack of liquidity, because the retail market, although it does provide liquidity, it's not nearly as liquid as your typical corporate, both due to the size of the offering makes it more liquid and the retail component. Another unique feature is that, kind of like preferred stock, interest is paid quarterly, not semi-annually. As I mentioned before, it's almost always unsecured. There's no covenants. They are a little more expensive. The underwriters in these charge an underwriting commission. The market is typically 3.15% compared to, you know, a larger corporate bond, which is, you know, 0.5, 0.65 to 0.875. Since we're over, I won't go too long into the documents required, but they're basically the same as any corporate debt issue that's registered. You have a registration statement, a prospectus. You do have a listing application, which you never do in a corporate bond. You have an underwriting agreement, term sheet, indenture, sometimes a roadshow deck, or marketing materials that the broker-dealers use to place it. Talking about the market, it's smaller, but it is, again, something that people tap now and then, business development companies more frequently than corporates. But currently there's about 200 series outstanding in a market of a little over $5 billion. An interesting one is, like, eBay did a $750 million offering a couple of years ago, which was a very large baby bond. issuance. I think they like the retail component, given that they're a retail-focused company. So that's kind of where the market is. Risks of baby bonds, I think that's a key takeaway, is that they trade like stock. So they will trade based off the $25 issue price, and people look at them that way, and the trading price gets impacted both by the credit of the company and the prospects of the company. That will make the baby bond trading price go down, but also it will trade down based on interest rates. So in a rising interest rate environment, the trading price will obviously go down. Conversely, in a falling interest rate, they go up. The one key takeaway is in risks of baby bonds is retail investors, particularly in baby bonds, they have a hold-to-maturity mentality. So when you put these out there, expect them to stay out there. They're very, very sticky. So as long as you're capable and have the cash flow to pay your interest on a quarterly basis, you kind of can forget about these. But if you ever have trouble in paying a coupon, to get a waiver is incredibly difficult because you're subject to the 14E rules of the debt tender rules of the 34 Act, and you have to do a full solicitation document, 20-day period of the debt tender. And frankly, these holders don't respond. They're notoriously unresponsive. So sometimes it can be difficult to hit the 50% you might need to change something. And frankly, when you get to maturity, principal, and interest, the key terms, you need 100%. Also related to that is occasionally some of the smaller investment banks might encourage you to put in some small covenant in order to get a better marketing or rate. I would advise strongly against that because getting it waived is virtually impossible because, these retail holders are just notoriously unresponsive. So I wouldn't do a baby bond issue if I had to put any covenant other than payment of principal and interest. And then lastly, understand for the same reason that during the no-call period, there really is no way to get these in. In a typical corporate bond, you can do a make-whole tender offer. Sophisticated investors will accept that, and you'll have a high, high success rate doing a make-whole tender. That will not happen in the baby bond world. It's literally they don't open the mail or they don't look at the screen, and even though you might even increase the terms a little bit above a make-whole or put a high spread, they're not, they just don't respond. So that's kind of a quick overview of baby bonds. We're all a little over, so I'll kind of turn it back to Mike for a summary. But as we said, any questions anybody has, we'll be happy to answer.
Thanks, Carol and Eric. Give us some concluding remarks and then the final CLE code as well.
Yeah, if you go through, Mike, there you go. Quick comparison on the various financing structures here. I'd also point out, if we continue to see a revival in the capital markets generally, I think we'll see a revival in CMPO offerings, which we can also talk to anyone about, so happy to do that. Key takeaway points, I think, from today, there's a lot of headwinds in the capital raising. There are some alternative financing structures out there that have become extremely popular in the last couple of months, and we've covered them here today. And so our Winston & Strawn capital markets team, here in Houston as well as Dallas and New York and Chicago and elsewhere, are ready and able to help on all of those fronts. CLE code, again, is 70932. That's 70932. We've gone over some overall time for questions today, but if you do have questions about the presentation or any current situation you're dealing with, do not hesitate to reach out to me, to anyone else on today's panel. We've got numerous clients right now navigating these challenging times and the headwinds in the capital markets area. So let us help you if we can. So thank you for attending today's webinar. The slides and an audio replay of the webinar will be available on our website soon. And you should also have received a link to the CLE evaluation form, which we'd love for you to complete. So thank you again, and we hope to see you at a future program, and have a great afternoon.